Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes, too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield and this is Drop Dead Serious. If you can believe it, it's been nearly 30 years, 29 to be exact. That is how long the JonBenet Ramsey case has haunted this country. A six-year-old little girl who performed in little mini beauty pageants, murdered in her own home, Christmas night, 1996. She was strangled with someone who was using a garrote. Her skull was fractured and a ransom note was left behind that has baffled investigators ever since. It's the case that should have been solved, but it wasn't. JonBenet's father, John Ramsey, has lived this nightmare since day one. They targeted him and his wife, Patsy, and they put them under something called an umbrella of suspicion for years and years and years. Basically, alluding to the fact that it's them, we just need to prove it. The headlines were obscene. You could not go to the grocery store without seeing some tabloid pointing to these two as the murderers. Life had to be hell. And I say had to be hell because years and years later, they walked it all back. They took that umbrella of suspicion away. They cleared the Ramseys and said, we're sorry. They were not the killers. They cleared them, but not before Patsy had already died of cancer. So Patsy died under an umbrella of suspicion as a potential murderer of her own six-year-old girl. And John had to deal with that. John is still demanding answers. He wants the murder of his little girl solved. And can you blame him? Even 3 decades later, he has gone through the gamut, right? He's A to Z. They've thrown everything at him. He wants that solved. He's not walking away saying, I want nothing to do with this anymore. I just want this gone. He wants it solved. He's still a crime fighter. I spoke with John and his wife, Jan, in depth at CrimeCon when we had a quiet moment to ourselves. And the conversation that we had really stopped me in my tracks. There were things that they told me I had not heard before, especially news about the garrote that was used to kill JonBenet. You and I, as you know, true crime fans, we say, well, obviously that's the murder weapon. They would have tested that right away. Not necessarily. John has been astounded that all of the items of evidence weren't tested right away for DNA. Some were, but not all. And to this day, he doesn't know how many more have been, or whether they've been retested, or what kind of updated science has been applied to this very cold case. They don't tell him. Can't fault the police for not tipping their hand. They're not supposed to. But imagine what it's like for this father, who was accused of being the killer, and who now just wants to find the killer. John Ramsey decided to talk to me on this podcast about our conversation about the garrote. And I do want to keep in mind here, folks, that when I talk to John, I'm mindful. He is a victim of crime. He's not just a subject or someone who's involved in crime fighting. He is a victim of crime as well. So sensitive conversation as well, even 29 years later. But without further ado, here's my conversation with John Ramsey. John, it's good to see you since our quick visit at CrimeCon. But
thank you. Same here.
Yeah, interesting conversations all around with regard to DNA testing in general and how far it's come, and then specifically to the case of your daughter. Talk to me a little bit about what you discussed and what you learned.
Well, excuse me. I have learned a lot in the very recent past. The term that now seems to define the latest technology is IgG, investigative genetic genealogy. And that's been used as a technique in the last couple of years to solve some really old cold cases. And it really is an investigative tool using DNA. And we don't have that, have not had that. We've had a DNA database, which is all the bad guys. And if you have a DNA sample from a crime scene, you go in and see if it's one of the bad guys. And if it doesn't match, then, okay, that DNA is only then useful for conviction. You really can't use it for investigating. Unless you want to go through one by one getting DNA samples from, in our case, the 80,000 people that were in Boulder, Colorado on December. So what IgG does is it enables you to go into these public databases where when they are available, and using the, as I understand it, the mother's X chromosome in a sample that you've taken from your crime scene, and then build a family tree. And it's a historic family tree. It goes back, okay, we know this mother was the parent of the perpetrator of the crime. Who's related to that mother? And you might go back, in our case, 30 years, develop a fairly complex family tree. And you'll get to where, hey, in 1996 in December, there was a third cousin related to this mother chromosome that lived in Boulder. Well, let's go check him out. Then you go get a DNA sample from that third cousin. And if you, what's happened in the past is remarkably had matches, absolute, confirming matches to the crime scene, the full crime scene DNA sample. And so it's a very powerful tool. And I believe that it's the only way our case might be solved. But I think
Let
if it's
in- ask you, have you learned any further whether the investigative bodies, whether it's Boulder Police or the FBI, or even the state police for that matter, have actually employed the newest crime fighting techniques like investigative genetic genealogy, you know, the things that have caught the Golden State Killer, the things that have allegedly led, you know, to other killer, well, Brian Koberger. Have you learned that they've been employing those techniques in your case?
I have not. And we've hammered on them pretty hard, very specifically used this IgG technique. Have not gotten any confirmation that they're using it. They listen. And, you know, the police department in the last year and a half, got new leadership, which was long overdue. They had very poor leadership back 30 years ago, and it continued up until a couple years ago. And so the leadership is much better, in my opinion, than it ever was. And they listen to us, but I've got no indication that they're moving in that direction.
And maybe, you know, maybe it's for the simple reason that they wouldn't want someone out there to know and go underground or go overseas. So I can understand if they keep close to the vest in that. And John, you and I have known each other a long time. Sometimes I think when people interview you, they forget you're a victim in all of this. And they just ask these questions and they use terms about your child's murder as though it's just another investigative conversation. So I just want to apologize in advance for any details that we discuss about the evidence in the case. Because, you know, when you lose a child, time doesn't heal wounds.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It changes you. But no, I'm able now to, you know, I want to solve this crime. It's not going to change my life at this point, but it'll change my children's lives. They need to have this cloud, even though it's fuzzy, removed from their life. They need to be able to move on to the next chapter in their lives. And it affects them. And that solution to this crime will benefit them.
Yeah, I mean, Burke has gone through hell.
It's absurd what he's gone through.
Yeah,
it's just nuts. He was a 9-year-old little boy, and never ever was considered a suspect by the police, ever.
But certainly by the mobs.
But the mobs did. Yeah, it was good sport.
Can you imagine if social media had existed back then?
Oh man, I can't. It'd have been a manslaughter.
Yeah,
it was bad enough with the tabloids and
the news
tabloid
channels.
Media.
I mean, the mainstream news, the legacy news, they all covered it wall to wall, covered the story and went with all of the pointed allegations, the umbrella of suspicion. I mean, it was always, always a tone.
Yeah, we were told by the DA in Boulder several years later that the police case was 100% based on the fact they didn't think we acted right that morning. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we were guilty. They weren't sure which one it was, mother, father, we were both in the house. And we understood they had to investigate us as a starting point, even though it was absurd, but we understood it. But their strategy became, let's bring intense pressure on both John and Patsy. The innocent one will buckle and turn the guilty one in. Case will be solved. That was the whole strategy. They couldn't take it to trial because they didn't think we acted right that morning. That's no basis for a charge. And there was unidentified male DNA found within 2 weeks of JonBenet's murder on her clothing. Huge problem for the police to pursue their conviction that it had to be the parents because it's always the parents. So it was a mess. But the real problem relative to the media was that the police released a lot of misleading and false information to a local paper in Boulder, which is now out of business. But they would report it just verbatim without fact-checking. And then the mainstream media would pick it up. And so that little effort to bring pressure on the family by releasing false information exploded on the police. I don't know if they planned it. I doubt it. They weren't that smart. But it sure did explode. And so
what's confounding to me is that this has been a blight on the legacy of the Boulder Police for 3 decades.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that it would be their number one priority. They would do anything in their potential toolkit to solve this and become the hero cops that did what the others couldn't do. Do you think that is a mission? Do you think it's not a mission? Like, where does that sort of theory stand?
I don't know. That's always been my... I've told the police, I said, look, I've been very critical of the police. That's not fair to you as the new leadership. You didn't cause this mess. And I'm sorry, but I don't have anything else to go on. And typically the questions are, how did this get to be such a mess? And it goes back to the leadership that was in place for 25, 26 years. Terrible leadership. The chief of police who for, I don't know, 25 years, came out of the traffic division, never investigated homicide, nor had any of his so-called detectives. So it was just a Keystone Cops department with poor leadership.
It just seems to me that they would want that fixed now, and that anyone in the leadership position would want to be that headline-grabbing hero that finally solved this incredibly cold case.
Totally agree. And I've told him that. I said, look, if you'll do everything that can be done, which in my mind is using IgG technology, and we come up empty-handed, I'm going to say, thank you for trying. You've done everything that can possibly be done. Thank you. I'm not going to criticize them for failure to get an answer because it's even that may not produce an answer. But it's really baffling. I don't know. The DA, he's a good guy, running for attorney general for the state. This would be a shoe-in for him to get elected as the attorney general if he led the he's the chief law enforcement officer in the county, technically.
When's the election?
Good question. I don't know. Is it Must be a year from now. I don't know. That's, I'm not sure.
Who knows if things will be, you know, timed. You know, that's not unheard of, but I don't want to throw that accusation out
well,
there. It's a possibility,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about the discussions at CrimeCon. And on one of the panels, the attorney named Hal Haddon told the audience that there was DNA on the garrote. And again, I'm sorry for bringing up this kind of painful evidence with you as a crime victim who lost your child. But this is so massive to me. And in all the years, I'm trying to remember if I've ever even heard that there was DNA on the garrote.
Well, on the garrote, no. What we didn't know, well, what we did know was that after John Monet's murder, a number of items were sent to an outside lab for sampling to see if there was crime, you know, DNA evidence from the crime scene. And they did recover unidentified male DNA on some of the items. And they returned another six or seven of them untested back to the police. And
meaning they found some unidentified male DNA. So that's enough. We don't need to test everything else. We found what we were looking
for. I think
for?
That is what I think happened. I mean, DNA testing was expensive back then.
Sure.
And that might have been an issue. And I said, well, we got unidentified male DNA. That's all we need. But for some reason, those other items were never tested, one of which was the garrote. And so we've always said, well, test them. Test those items that haven't been tested. But the other thing that's important, and I learned this in my process of understanding the whole system, the sample we have from 1997, and then it was confirmed with additional sampling in 2006, I think, is in a format that's compatible with the federal database. That format is not compatible with IgG. They need a different technique in developing the sample.
Like a different DNA modeling, you mean?
Yeah,
it's apples and oranges. You can't take this apple and compare it with the database that has oranges.
Exactly.
And so do we know if that is happening, that sort of, because I know, I'm not a scientist, but I know that we are so far advanced in DNA technology that they can do that.
They can. And I don't have any indication that they are doing it. I don't have any indication that they aren't doing it. So I don't know. I'm only hoping that they will see the value in doing it. I know their original, when I talked to them a year ago, they didn't want to do any more testing because they said, we don't want to consume the sample. We have a very small sample. And it's okay, I understand that. But in talking to these cutting-edge labs, they can work with 100 picograms, very little, nothing.
Right. This is what we learned in Koberger, that they had a very small sample and Othram was able to extrapolate from that and get the actual model that they needed to do the genetic testing.
Yep.
And that's what's just so confounding to me. Like, and again, I don't know the evidence. I don't know. But it seems to me it's not one sample. There was, and again, my apologies for bringing up the realities of the evidence in the case, because it's very painful just to me. And I'm not John Bonet's parent. There was DNA on her underwear. There was DNA on the leggings. There was DNA now on this garrote. There was DNA found on a lot of pieces of evidence from the crime scene. So it seems to me that that is not such a microscopic sample.
No, it isn't. And it's pretty hard to exist without leaving DNA around.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
The trick was our technology that could recover it. Well, it's advanced so far that it can be recovered from a hair sample in the case of the case you just mentioned. And we have unidentified hair samples that came from the blanket around JonBenet. We have a pubic hair sample. There's sufficient, in my opinion, crime scene material that could be tested using today's technology. Get it in the right format to do the genealogy research.
And again, we don't know if it is happening. You know, we don't know
We
because,
don't.
like,
And, you know, on the one hand, I respect the police for, you know, a good professional police department. It's not going to tell you what they're up to.
that's
And
right.
I respect that. That was one of the problems with Boulder. They just had an open door to the tabloids, anybody else that wanted to come in and write a story. I guess it was their opportunity to, their 5 minutes of fame, you know?
If the killer is out there, now 30 years older, right? 20? Are we at
Yeah.
29 or 20? I'm trying to do
Well,
the math. Is it 20? Coming up on 28, 29?
it's coming up on,
Three decades. You know,
yeah,
long
3
time.
years.
If the killer is still out there, still alive, and my thinking is that yes, because you know it is a young man's game to do the kind of break and enter that would have been required to do this crime in your house.
Right.
So my feeling
Agreed.
is maybe 30, 40, maybe he's 60, 70.
Agreed.
It does stand to reason, though, that if he gets wind that Boulder police got its act together and actually is now gumshoeing, looking for the Rex Heuermann pizza box. You know, they followed Rex Heuermann on the streets of Manhattan and they picked up the pizza box he threw in the garbage
Yeah.
after lunch, and inside were the crusts he was gnawing with his DNA-laden saliva.
Yeah.
So maybe that person would be more cautious, like Brian Koberger was, in putting all of his garbage into little plastic bags, which didn't save him, but you know what I mean.
No, that's a valid concern. And that would be a good reason why the police are not talking. And I understand that.
And
But
we're
I think
talking about,
they're
you know, Othram Labs' work on Brian Koberger sample was not even 3 years ago. It'll be 3 years ago this Thanksgiving, because they actually said at CrimeCon that they were asked during Thanksgiving weekend to go into the lab, leave your family's dinner table and go into the lab and get this for us. We're against the clock, and they did it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not very old technology that they were working with, and you know that we became aware of that
Yeah.
they could extrapolate these small DNA samples. So for one thing, we don't know if Othram has been contacted, right, by the Boulder Police?
Well, as far as we know, no, they have not. We we met with Othram at CrimeCon, the Middlemans, and they said, no, we haven't been contacted by
Oh,
the.
they were forthright. They said
No.
no. They didn't say, listen, we have a confidentiality agreement. We can't say who
Mm-mm.
our clients are. They said no. Well, that's distressing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And
Did
that's
you did
concerning. If
yeah,
they
did
said, no, we can't talk to you, sorry, we'd have said, okay, fine, we understand. And we would have
Yeah.
said, okay, maybe they are talking to him. That's good enough. But
That's a little more hopeful, yeah.
yeah.
But here's my question. Did you take that? I mean, we're just CrimeCon was only a week ago. So have you
Right.
taken that to the Boulder Police? Do you have regular meetings? And do you plan to
No.
say, listen, what on earth could you possibly be waiting for?
We have not taken that to the police yet. I'm actually drafting a letter to the DA, who's the chief. He's the head
Crime fighter in the
crime
county, yeah.
fighter in the county. Yeah, so he's the head guy, and that I haven't sent it yet, but it's concerning. Now maybe they've chosen another lab. There may be another lab or two out there that have that capability, but I am very reasonably familiar with what Othram can do. And
And the success that they have
oh
had.
man, it's dramatic. And the piece that I learned that they can do, which I always wonder, okay, we get this sample and it's called SNPs, SNP is the sample format that's needed for this genealogy research. If we get it in the SNP format, who's going to do the research? That's a big job to develop the family tree and all the research that's required. And I thought the police department doesn't have that bandwidth to do it. Well, I learned that Othram has a staff of geneticists to do that.
Wow, one-stop shop.
Yeah. Holy mackerel, that answers that question.
So you're writing a letter to the DA right now to say what is happening? If you haven't appealed to Othram, why haven't you? And is there, I mean, how many companies exist out there like Othram?
I don't know. Probably less than a half a dozen, I would say, worldwide. Maybe not even that many. I'm aware of a couple, three.
And it would seem to me that Othram would be sort of a natural choice. Like, I don't know their politics, and I don't know with their conversations if they've had, you know, whatever they've had about what lab to choose, if they are choosing one. But my God, with the success that they had with Koberger sample, and he's put away for life based on it, you know,
yeah.
It would seem natural.
It would be the place I'd go to if I was running the place. No question, you know, a no-brainer.
Did you ever hear, and I don't know how many conversations you have with the Boulder police. Let me start there. How often do you actually talk to them? As a victim of this crime, I would think that there'd be an advocate that you could reach out to any time. Is that the relationship?
Well, they are under law, I don't know if it's Colorado law, to give us a briefing once a year. They have to do that. And we had that briefing in January. I asked for a meeting with Chief Redfern while I was in Denver this past week, and he agreed to give me 30 minutes. Week before CrimeCon. So it was, 2 weeks ago.
So you had your meeting with him, or he agreed already?
No, I had the meeting with him while I was in Denver.
How'd that go?
It was fine. It was good, very open. And again, we recognized that he only had 30 minutes to spare. So we were trying to be very brief, but very focused on IGG.
And?
He listened. That was pretty much it. Now, they did say they'd sent some samples off again for testing to CBI, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. And I would have felt better if they'd said we sent it off to Othram or an Othram like.
And let me ask you, I mean, my gosh, I can't even believe we're hearing, 30 years since the crime, and we're sending some more samples off for testing. Is that the time that the garrote was tested and it came back with male DNA?
No, I don't. There's a question whether the garrote was ever tested. According to our information, which is old, it was never sampled for DNA. Now, we've heard through the grapevine that, yes, it was sampled, and they did find male DNA on the garrote.
Is that a recent finding, that this
I don't
grapevine?
Know. It was a secondhand, not a direct source.
Okay. But where was Hal Haddon, the attorney who said that at CrimeCon, where was he getting this information that he stated unequivocally DNA testing on the knots on the garrote had never been done? But
that's all we knew.
Yeah.
And technically, we don't know. I wouldn't say it's an unreliable source, but it's not a firsthand source that told us. No, that's right. It wasn't somebody from the police department.
But to be fully clear, it shocks me that DNA on the garrote had never been tested. Like, what? That's
well,
the murder
yeah,
weapon. If, why would they if, never test the DNA on the murder weapon, for God's sake?
I know. If that is true, if it remains true, then yeah, that's a very pointed question. What in the world are you guys doing? We don't know with 100% certainty that's true.
So, and the chief obviously wouldn't divulge the specifics of the evidence, but said that some new evidence had been sent off for
testing. Well, he didn't say new. Mm. So we don't know. I mean,
could have been retested.
Could be. He didn't say that, but that's would be our hope that that's what they're doing. It's you know, as Jaminet's father, I'd like to talk to him every day. What are you doing today? But I realize that's just not going to happen, and I understand why. You know, they are certainly a much more professional organization than we've dealt with for the last 25 years.
Will they speak to you more often than once a year? I know you had this meeting this fall, and then you had one in January. But they will. They're at least willing to speak. Again, victims' advocates exist for the reason that they need to speak with you.
Well, we found that the Chief Redfern's been very willing to meet with us when we've asked. He's had a couple times we've asked, and he was out of town, so it didn't work. But no, I think he's willing to talk to us whenever we ask. Now, they do have a victim's advocate program, which we met with very early on. And it was kind of funny because at that time we were the number one suspects.
Sure.
And so we met with a victim's advocate person. She said, well, this is really awkward because you're not the victim, you're the suspect. It was kind of a funny meeting.
And were they unwilling to do the right kind of job that they are actually paid to do when it came to you because they thought you were suspects?
I don't remember. It was so long ago, but it was a very brief meeting.
Maybe you could rekindle that. Maybe you could
rekindle it's possible. A new one. Yeah, it's possible.
Actually, maybe pop that in that letter. You know, to the DA saying, I would personally, as the father of a murder victim and an unsolved crime, would like someone appointed my point person as a victim's advocate so that I can get regular updates.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Hey,
we'll
it's
do
the
it.
Least they can do after what they did to you.
I know it. Well,
apologies are all lovely when they're public, but where's show me the money? If your apology is sincere for having painted Patsy and you know, as the umbrella of suspicion suspects, and then only to walk that all back and apologize, you know, show me the money. Speaking of money, let me ask you something. Did anyone ever say that it is expensive, this process is expensive, and that perhaps the Boulder police don't have this kind of money?
Well, I brought that up to the DA and the chief of police, who we met with, the first time we met with him, which, gosh, was over a year ago. And I said, look, if money is an issue, if budget's an issue, we can find the money. We'll get the money. And the DA said, nope, that is not an issue. It is not a problem.
They've said the money is not an issue, or we don't want you to.
Well, they said money wasn't an issue.
Okay.
So we said, fine. Well, then.
It didn't seem to be an issue in Idaho. And I mean, come on. Latah County isn't bursting with big taxpayer base. It's got University of Idaho there. But so it doesn't seem that. And of course, there's always the avails of the FBI and the federal system. I mean, I've never heard money being an issue, but I was going to ask you if it is, if you've ever thought of launching a GoFundMe to.
Well, I
to
don't
help
think.
Solve.
Yeah, we said we can get the money. And I had some by then rebuilt. We pretty much got wiped out financially. Most victims of violent crime end up broke, I was told by the FBI, because it's such an expensive, you're traumatized, you're making bad decisions, you're selling the house, you're moving, it's just, money goes fast and you make bad decisions.
Do you have any idea what your legal bills were, you know, have you ever done the math on that?
It wiped us out basically. And you know, it's like, if you're going to have heart surgery, you want to be sure you get a good heart surgery. You don't do it on a budget. But our attorneys worked for years without getting paid. We, after a couple of years, said, guys, we're out of money. They said, don't worry about it.
Really?
Yeah. So they remain.
And not to be too prying, but I am curious about what that did cost you. Like, what did you pay out to try to just fend off the onslaught?
Well, it was all we had, basically. And I don't think it'd be fair to the attorneys to say a number, but when we first engaged them, and they're brought in to our life by a good friend who said, you need an attorney. Trust me. So, okay. And we started getting some pretty hefty bills because they also hired investigators to see, you know, to do their job. And the first couple bills, after the first couple, they were pretty big. They said, this is not going to go on. This is ridiculous that we have to do this. Don't worry about it. Well, it went on for 2-3 years till we just were out of money. And we said, guys, we can't keep funding this. And they said, don't worry about it. Not important. They became very committed to righting a very terrible wrong. And that was the assault that was made on, in their eyes, Patsy and I.
And you and Patsy lived a really nice lifestyle. Were you able to earn back enough to match that lifestyle again? Like, how did it affect your ability to live in the manner you were accustomed to?
Yeah, now we haven't gotten back to where we were, but we're certainly good enough. I was in the computer industry in its infancy, and you had to be really stupid to not make reasonable money at that time in the period of the computer industry. And we were lucky. We got involved in some things that worked really well and ended up with more money than I thought I'd ever have. And Patsy and I were discussing, well, maybe we should just take a year off. Let's homeschool the kids and let's travel. And then, of course, that was not that far before we lost JonBenet that we were kicking that around as an idea. And we were not crazy with our expenses. We could get by okay. And that's kind of where we were in our lifestyle or situation. And so then it all kind of crashed and burned. But through some friends that helped me get back on my feet with a job. And it was tough. I couldn't get another job easily because I was a very tarnished fellow. I had one friend that said, we'd love to have you come work for our company, but we can't afford to have our good company name on the front of the National Enquirer. And I totally understand it.
Unemployable.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, I remember...
For a while, for a period.
I remember Casey Anthony's father saying the same thing to me. He said, I lost my job and I started trying to get jobs, which was hard enough. And when I finally got one, it was stocking grocery shelves, which was quite a fall from where he had been.
Yeah.
And he told me over lunch one day in Orlando before the trial, he said, I was stocking shelves on a night shift when somebody recognized me. I can't remember if it was somebody in the staff or whether the store was closed or if it was the public, but he said somebody recognized me and the next day it was over. The meager job I had stocking grocery store shelves to try to feed what was left of my family. I lost that job too. And he says the same thing, that's what everybody told him. Even people who loved him said, I can't be associated with this.
Yeah, no. And I understood that totally. But fortunately, we were able to get back with a paycheck coming in and get
back some semblance of life the way it was, although it never ever would be.
No, it was a fraction of what it was.
Sean, we're all taught to face adversity in your life. You're always going to face adversity and it's how you meet it. But my God, do you ever wonder how you've survived this?
Well, I think, when I lost Beth, my oldest daughter, I was a worrier. I'd worry about lots of things, things I shouldn't worry about, but I did. I never worried about losing a child.
Right. And that was before JonBenet.
Yeah, that was a few years before. And it really knocked me down totally. I was just devastated. Beth was 22 years old and just gotten out of college, started a new job, and was killed in a car accident. And it took me years to be able to track going, and I was still working, but if I was on an airplane by myself, I'd start to cry just by myself because it was just so heavy. But it really caused me to address my faith, which frankly was fairly weak back then. And, why does God let this happen to a wonderful, innocent child? A friend of mine took me aside, who I'd known as a business associate for several years, and said, look, I want to help you study the Bible. He said, we're going to meet once a week, and the first week we're going to read the first paragraph of, I forget which book he was in. I said, well, I can read the whole book in 20 minutes. I could, or the whole chapter in 20 minutes. Why just the first paragraph? Well, it really taught me how to dig into it. And over a period of a few years, a couple of years, my intellectual faith kind of moved to my heart. And so I had that base that there's more life than what we see. There is a God. There is a heaven. Beth's in heaven. I'm confident of that. So when I lost JonBenet, I had that foundation, which helped a lot.
Did the church help? I'm wondering what it was like in the congregation, because again, everybody was reading the same papers and looking at you and Patsy. What was the congregation like?
Well, they were fine. They were wonderful. And, you know, that's the other thing that was interesting. Early on, people say, how is it to be out in public? I said, it's wonderful. People are so kind to us and apologetic for what's being said to us. So people, and these are people we didn't necessarily know, that would stop us in the street. And early on, we were traveling back to Atlanta from Denver, and I had my cheap coach tickets, and the ticket agent was clicking away on his computer and handed me two first-class boarding passes and said, this is because I believe in you.
Wow.
And this was early on. And
so you found public support even when the police were putting out those headlines and the headlines were pointing to you and vilifying you. You found the people weren't buying into it.
Right. Absolutely. We were just overwhelmed by kindness. And it really made me a more compassionate person. The other thing I learned, which I guess I was just not paying attention to, were people around me had their own burdens to carry. I had one friend I'd worked with for several years. Said, oh, yeah, I lost a child. And I thought, oh, my God, I didn't know that. And so it made me realize that life's not easy. And we all carry a burden of some
John,
sort. Some
nobody,
of them are pretty.
I don't know anybody.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Who's carried yours? You know the business I'm in. I mean, like, I meet a lot of people who obviously are in the worst circumstance of a potential life on earth. And I've never met anybody who's had the boots taken to them like you have. And that's why I just sort of ask, and maybe your answer has helped me, that if it hadn't been for the foundation of your faith going into this terrible tragedy with JonBenet, maybe you might not have managed the way you have.
I think that's probably right. You know, Patsy said it well when and we didn't pay much attention to the headlines that were just so accusatory. She said, you can't hurt me any more than I've been hurt by the loss of my child. That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's minor stuff compared to my hurt from losing my child. And that's kind of how we felt. And in a way, it was a diversion from grieving, because we had to figure out how to get Burke to school. And there's cameras and satellite trucks parked out in front of the house we're staying in. How do we get him to school without being put? We were frightened. You know, who did this to our family? We wanted to protect Burke, who at the time was 9 years old.
Was he in fourth grade? I'm thinking ninth.
He was fourth. Yeah, I think that's right.
How was that? I bet nobody even talks about that. But how was it with you and Patsy and his school and the classmates? Like, what did you do?
Well, they were
try
great.
To give him normalcy.
The parents in Burke's class formed a Burke watch, and they got a little alarm that they could call the police just by pushing a button. And they were out, well, there's a parent in the classroom every day, all day long, and they volunteered, and they did try it once. They had to try it. A Japanese TV film crew invaded the the school, and they, you know, called for the police. Police never came.
Police never came?
No. But that was the only time they had the alarm.
Do you think that the alarm didn't work, or do you think that the police didn't care? I can't imagine they wouldn't care at an elementary school.
No, I don't think it was that they didn't care. We had another case where we were being chased by a reporter in our car, and pulled into the to a drive-through bank and said to the teller, "Would you please call the police? Tell them we're being aggressively pursued by this car behind us." And they did, and the police showed up, and that was the end of that. So I maybe the alarm didn't work. I don't know. But the key is that the parents in Burke's class cared enough to spend their time on the Burke watch duty, and that went on for months.
I've never heard that. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is. No, people were wonderful to us. They really were. And I don't know of any instance where we were yelled at or harassed at all.
Yeah. Well, I go back to thank God, John, there wasn't social media.
Yeah, I know. That would really stir up people for sure.
I know that the crime against JonBenet was 3 decades ago, but trolls find their targets no matter what. Have you been targeted by trolls now who are looking back at the cold case and deciding it's still you? Have you had any of that?
No. We haven't had that in a long time. Early on, we did. In fact, I got a letter from somebody in New York, and it was very accusatory. And if you ever come to New York, I'm going to find you and I'm going to kill you. And I wrote him back and said, "Congratulations, you've written the most, the strongest accusation letter I've received so far. Congratulations."
Did you turn it over to the police? Because that is a felony. Death threat is a felony.
I know. They were not paying any attention to anything we were doing. Early on, you know, one of the real interesting leads we got actually came from the DA's office. This is early on. And he called our attorneys, we had two private detectives working for the attorneys now. And he said, "I got this lead. It's pretty interesting. I don't think the police will follow up on it. Would you have your investigators follow up on it?" And they did.
The DA is asking you to have your investigators follow a lead that the DA received.
Because the DA didn't think the police would follow up on it. He knew their mindset was
got it.
So locked.
Well, that's nice to know. That's early on, too.
Oh, it was very early on.
Shocking.
Yeah.
And did the lead pan out?
Well, it was a very interesting lead. And when our attorneys described the circumstantial information that was given to us, I said, "That's the guy." They said, whoa, slow down. Don't do a Boulder police on us. We don't know that yet. I thought, yeah, you're right. We don't. It's very easy to rush to judgment. I can give you 4 or 5 circumstantial people that we got information on. And you'd say, my God, that's got to be the person. But it doesn't pan out. The DNA doesn't match but it's convincing. Well, it taught me that to be a detective, it takes a really strong, smart guy with the ability to focus on evidence. And that's
and
what Luke Smith. And
be
discerning.
Open. Yeah.
That's
the
piece that was missing.
The open.
Discerning
yeah,
and common discerning. Sense. It just didn't exist.
Exactly. You know, but every time I think of your case, and it is often, I just keep thinking we are not living in the era of Jack the Ripper. I get why those crimes aren't solved. We are living in a different era, and is plenty of evidence. And so I truly believe, and I think you do too, that this crime will be solved.
I think if we employ IgG technology, there's a 70% chance we'll get an answer, maybe higher.
Why do you end on 70?
I don't know. I don't want to say for sure, because there may be, I mean, it's still a search technology, investigative technology, the tool you use, and it's possible it could come up to a dead end. I don't know. But I think it's the most powerful tool we have to solve this case. And I think there's a high probability it could be solved.
I agree. Tell me a little bit about, again, at CrimeCon, I must have missed this. I think I was on the other end of the convention center, but Gary Oliva wanted to, now, and remind our viewers, Gary was a suspect early on, a registered sex offender in the area. I think they had questioned him and considered him, but in the end didn't pursue him as a suspect, correct? And he wanted to find you. Like, first of all, take me back to who Gary Oliva is, and then what.
Well, that was the lead we got from the DA early on that I mentioned earlier.
That was the Gary lead.
Yeah. Okay. And it always gets down to, is there a DNA match? And I presume his DNA was taken and there was no match. But that's as far as it went, as far as I know.
Did they never make an announcement and say he's cleared? He's not under an umbrella of suspicion? Did they ever do anything like that?
I don't think so. To my knowledge, no.
So he wasn't named, it wasn't cleared as a suspect?
He wasn't, not to my knowledge.
He confessed, right, in letters?
No. That was John Mark Carr.
I knew about John Mark Carr, but Gary Oliva never made any confessions?
Well, the information we got, and I saw this on television, he called a friend of his that night, early in the morning of the 26th, said, "I've just heard a little girl." And then his friend, a day later saw this. And he was in Boulder, Gary Oliva was. And so his friend called the police and said, "Hey, this guy I know called me and said he just heard a little girl." And that was before there's anything public on JonBenet's murder. I saw him interviewed, the friend, not that long ago. And he seemed like a pretty solid citizen. And so you think, well, what in the world took place? Why did that call happen? Why did he say that to this friend? So it's
well, I mean, listen, none of us can understand why some of these people do what they do, like John Mark Carr coming out and loving the attention of it all for such a horrendous deed. And it was proven it was not his DNA at the crime scene. But Gary Oliva wanted to meet you at CrimeCon. What happened there?
Well, he said he wanted to meet through a person that was also in CrimeCon and said he wanted to apologize to you. And I said, "What's he going to apologize for? Murdering my daughter? I don't know. What else he could apologize for?" No, he just wanted to apologize for the trouble you've been through. And I didn't have any interest in meeting him. He's a convicted sex offender, child predator, felon. So no, I didn't meet with him. But it was unusual, I thought.
Yeah. Did he, you know how CrimeCon works? It's pretty open. You have meet and greets, you have autograph times. And I know that sounds odd for maybe anybody watching right now or listening right now who hasn't had an experience at CrimeCon. But, you know, the people who want to meet you and get your autograph or get a photograph with you are supporters. They love you.
Oh,
they want the
wonderful
opportunity to hug you and
tell
you that they
love you. Oh, yeah. I got more hugs than you could count. It was wonderful. People are so gracious to us.
They really are at CrimeCon. Yeah. It really is, for lack of a better description, a love fest. I mean.
Yeah. No, I went to the first one 3 years ago. A friend, in Paula Woodward, who had written a book on our case, and she's an investigative reporter that followed our case for years. And she was invited to go, and she asked me if I would go with her. And I said, yeah, okay. I had no idea what CrimeCon was, but I thought I wanted to help Paula. So I went, and I was just overwhelmed by the support and the encouragement, and it really re-energized me to keep fighting.
Yeah. I've heard this from you first, and then from others like Joe Petito as well, that this is a place where you find you live in a world that there's no manual for living, right? No one ever tells you how life is to be lived once you go through what you've been through. And and here are these people to say, whatever it takes, we're here for you, and we love you. And what a what an incredibly
supportive place. Oh, it's wonderful. No, that's, say, from almost day one, that's been our experience with people. They've been wonderful to us and supportive and apologetic for what had been done to us by the police and the media. So it was wonderful. One of my favorite stories was Patsy was downtown Atlanta, crazy traffic, waiting to cross the street. She'd been to visit a friend in a hospital. This yellow cab screeches to a halt. This big guy gets out and traffic stops. Are you Patsy Ramsey? He said, yeah. I just want to give you a hug. I'm so sorry. He gave her a big hug, got back in his cab, and kept going.
When was that?
Oh, gosh, this was years ago. It'd been probably early 2000s, I suppose.
So enough time had passed since the murder.
Yeah.
That he'd lived through all the headlines. He'd seen.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But
yeah,
hadn't seen the apology yet.
Right. No, definitely that.
I think the apology came in 2005, 6, or 7. I know because I was pregnant with my two boys in those 3 years. And I know it was at that time.
Yeah. No, that was way before that. But, you know, people are not stupid. Most people have a good level of common sense and intuition, and you know, they knew we were getting a raw deal. And you know, when couple in England lost their daughter to a kidnapper, forget their names anyway, when I saw them being interviewed and talked, two doctors, there's no way they harmed their child or did something horrible.
Are you thinking of the Madeleine McCann? Parents?
Yeah.
The Madeleine McCann parents also went through a little bit of what you went
through.
They did.
They were focused on. And, you know, I've told people.
Did you reach out to them, John?
No, I never did. But I could, my just my common sense human perception was that they didn't. They're not guilty of that. Good Lord.
Takes a certain kind of mind to go there, though. And there are plenty of them that do that.
Well, yeah. No, I know. People were wonderful to us.
Did Gary Oliva try to find you at one of your panels or at the, because those were very public and they were announced and there were meeting times. And did he try to find you and was he fended off?
No. He didn't, not, to my knowledge. I just knew he was there, but
I was just going to say, I'm glad that you didn't face that spectacle.
Yeah, it would serve no purpose. And he's not a nice guy. He's got not somebody I want to have a drink with.
Well, and he has no business inserting himself into your troubles and your struggles, which you know are ongoing. Anything I've missed that I don't know to ask you about that I haven't found out? Anything that is new?
No. That's where we are today. You know, I semi jokingly said I need to get Trump involved. He tends to stir things up. And he voiced an opinion on the Cracker Barrel event. Maybe this is more important. I thought, yeah, maybe I should write him a letter. Because Lynn Wood, who was our defamation attorney for years, got involved in the 2020 deal, lost his law license because of his effort, or rightly or wrongly, to claim that the election was rigged on behalf of Trump. I mean, he was definitely a strong Trump supporter. So I don't know. But
Are you going to reach out? Are you going to reach out to President Trump to see if there's something he can, pressure he can put on the case?
Only if I thought there could be that would help. And I don't know that yet. What would I ask him to do?
Put the pressure on the FBI to step things up?
Well, the FBI has always been eager, as far as I know, to get involved in this case.
Still getting the Heisman from the Boulder police? That can't be possible.
I think there's been some opening, not a huge amount, but the FBI had, and I heard this from the chief of police as well, spent thousands of man hours putting together the case file for the police prior to this cold case review that was finally instituted after we petitioned the governor. Mm-hmm. So they've been involved and I think could do more.
Well,
I think, you know, but I don't know what they're doing.
You think about what can President Trump add to the mix? Well, we've already talked about the fact that the DA wants to run for governor, and we know what the president can do for or against someone who he doesn't think is doing his bidding. So there's one area. He
yeah,
also
that's
has
a good point.
Quite a bit of influence over the FBI and Cash Patel. That's for sure as well.
Yeah.
So is this an area you think you might mine?
Possibly. I think the FBI is ready, willing, and able to do a lot, but they have to be asked and invited by the police to do it. And up until recently, they won't let them do anything, is my understanding.
And the governor of Colorado isn't helpful?
No, not really. We wrote, you know, we had that petition that was started in CrimeCon 3 years ago, and I was shocked that we now have 55,000 signatures on that petition.
Jeez.
For the governor to intervene, get the DNA testing done properly and so forth. We sent a letter to 2.5 years ago, after we had these wonderful number of signatures, and he kind of ignored it. And so we published the letter. And then he responded and referred us to his director of public safety, who at the time, I'm told, was a good guy. And I sent him another email, I don't know, a month later, the governor, and said, well, you've been blocked by the recipient. So his staff apparently blocked my email. So
the
I couldn't.
The governor blocked your email?
Yeah. That's the message I got when I went to send him another email a month later. And that got out in the media, and his staff said, oh, no, we didn't block him. Well, baloney, they did.
I must have missed that headline. You said that did make headlines. I didn't see that.
Well, it wasn't headlines, but it came out at some level, maybe in the Denver area, I don't know. And his staff said, oh, no, we didn't block Mr. Ramsey's email. Well, according to the message I got back, you have been blocked by the recipient. And this message cannot be delivered. So,
did you try delivering another message to see if you were unblocked?
Good point. No, I did not.
You should try. I'd like to see that.
That's a great idea. I will try that.
That is heartless.
Yeah. Well, you know, what we found was the politicians in Colorado they didn't want to touch our case. They want to get involved. They didn't want to, because it was such a firestorm around it. You know, politicians, they exist to get reelected or run for the next highest office, usually. Few of them are there to really do a good job and do it right. But I know that the governor came out. This was the governor at the time of JonBenet's murder came out and had some, you know, the Ramseys need to come back and help us solve this case and quit hiding behind their lawyers, and which was not at all what we were doing.
Wow.
But his press agent told our attorneys, well, his ratings went up after he made that speech.
And yet all these people out in the public were so nice to you. It doesn't make any sense. You know?
Oh, yeah. No, I know. It nothing computed. But we felt all along that the public was very supportive and apologetic to us for what had been done. And say, who was it? Gallup did a poll fairly early on in this process, mess, and 70% of those polled felt that the family, the parents, were guilty. And this was probably within a year or two of it happening. And so the media had been very effective in convincing people that we were guilty. And yet we were so kindly treated in real life.
It doesn't make sense.
It didn't make sense, I know.
Doesn't compute. Well, stay, John, stay on the effort. Nobody will fight like you will. You know, no one will fight for your case to be resolved like you will.
Right.
We are all our own medical advocates, and we're all our own legal advocates, it seems. And if,
good point.
If we're not at the helm of our own cases, and if there's anything we can do, you know, I'm always speed dial for you.
Well, thanks, Ashley. You've always been very kind, and we appreciate the attention you give our case.
My great thanks to John Ramsey for joining me and for continuing to push for accountability after all these years, and to push for the crime-fighting efforts to continue in as robust a fashion as they were from day one. I really do believe it when I say it. I think JonBenet's crime is going to be solved. I think that killer is shaking in his boots, and I think those boots are being followed by gumshoe detectives who will catch him and will find him and hopefully bring him to justice. I'm Ashley Banfield, and remember, the truth isn't just serious, it's drop-dead serious.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.